I'm very happy now to welcome Zach Smith. He's an attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and he's co-author of the new report, Net Loss, The Killing of Marine Mammals in Foreign Fisheries. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So it turns out, and I found this really shocking, that 650,000 whales and dolphins and other marine mammals are killed or badly injured every year by foreign fleets, foreign fisher people, who are exporting fish to the United States for our consumption. How are they getting killed? What does this look like?
Right. Well, the way that it happens is that this is called bycatch, and basically marine mammals get caught, entangled, or hooked in different types of fishing gear that are used. And the 650,000 is an estimate for all of the marine mammals around the globe. That's not just to supply the U.S. market. That's the yearly rate of just going out and, you know, fishing with commercial fisheries around the world. And what happens is, of course, if they get caught in, say, a gill net, which is, you know, these gill nets can be kilometers long, and they're placed in the ocean, and it's almost like a wall. Of course, water can move through, but fish and other things can't. And when they hit it, they become entangled. And for marine mammals, then they would drown. And they can get hooked on long lines. There's the trawls that people are aware of that kind of drag close to the bottom. So if there's any ground fish and any species that feed off of ground fish in the marine mammal world, they can get caught as well. And so, yeah, it's a really staggering number. And when you think that the United States imports 91% of its fish that it consumes from foreign countries, we have a role to play in pushing back and perhaps making a dent in that 650,000 number and bringing it down if those foreign companies will use our methods.
Well, that's something that, again, I think is very important to know, is that there is a law, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, that exporters of fish to the United States, foreign fisher people, are supposed to use, and that we do use. So basically, U.S. fishing fleets don't have this problem of catching dolphins and whales and so on. What's the nature of this act that we use that is, in fact, effective?
Right. So what happened is that 40 years ago, when Congress passed the Marine Mammal Protection Act, they were getting at, in part, there was a lot of elements of the act, of course, but one of the things was to address this issue of bycatch from commercial fisheries. And it took them a while to actually get all the kinks out. There were amendments to the act over the year. But at the end of the day, it was two-pronged. And one prong was, let's tackle domestic fisheries, and let's create incentives and requirements for better practices in domestic fisheries. And that can result in things such as gill nets that have pingers on them, which would send out, you know, a slight noise that would warn, say, harbor porpoises that a net is there, so stay away. You can also make gear modifications so that, say, you have a long line. There are a line that attaches, say, a crab pot to the ocean floor, and then the line that takes it to the surface, the buoy at the surface, so you know where the crab pot is. That line, of course, represents an entanglement challenge or an entanglement problem for, like, the North Atlantic right whale or a humpback whale. And what you can do is you can create breakpoints for those lines so that if there's a particular amount of pressure applied to them, that the line will actually break, and thus there's less opportunity or less chance of the whale getting entangled. Those are the kinds of things that U.S. fishers do. There's also time and area closures where they could say, look, this is a time of year where there are a lot of marine mammals in this area, so maybe you shouldn't do your fishing during this time of year. Those are the things that U.S. fishermen are required to do, and foreign fishers are required to do too. That's the second prong of the act, but that's the part of the act that the government has never enforced. They don't even have regulations on the books.
So it's supposed to happen, it's law, but it's not enforced. It sounds like it might be a little bit difficult to enforce. I mean, we're talking about enforcing how fishing boats are working in China, Italy, the Pacific Ocean, places like that.
Well, yes, and actually it's a global, I mean, it hits every single, you know, 120 countries or so that export products to the United States. It's a huge undertaking. Fortunately, the way that the law is set up, and I don't know what the regulations will look like. They're currently in draft form. No one's seen them. They're kind of circulating within the government. But when those regulations come out, hopefully they will kind of line up with the law. And the law said it's the countries that have to certify. So this isn't necessarily a burden on individual fishers or fleets that are out there. It's the country where the fish comes from. So in the case of Canada, for example, Canada will have to put forward information detailing not only that it has good rules on the books for protecting harbor porpoises or North Atlantic right whale in the western North Atlantic, but that they actually know that it's working to reduce bycatch. And that's the real key here, too, because you can imagine a lot of countries just passing a law saying, oh, yeah, be nice to marine mammals, don't take them when you're fishing. But if they're not enforced properly and there isn't proof of that enforcement, which we do require in the U.S. for our own fishermen, then this law will be ineffective.
Is it really working in the United States?
Right, and I'm glad you raised that question because earlier we discussed that, you know, that we have this great program in the United States. I think we have a great program in the United States, but it's not perfect, and it's not perfect because we still have a lot of marine mammal take that does occur here. I think that the number I saw most recently was something around 6,000 animals per year or something in that range. And we still have threats to the North Atlantic right whale and other species from fishing practices in the U.S. The difference between the U.S. and other countries, though, is that even though we have our challenges here, our fishermen aren't off the hook, so to speak. There is a regime in place to bring them to reduce bycatch and for opportunities for organizations like mine and the public to put pressure on them and use laws against U.S. fishers to try to get them to do better practices. And that doesn't happen in the rest of the world. So if we identify fisheries here that are problematic for marine mammals, and there are fisheries still that aren't doing the best job, there are ways in which we can use the laws to say, well, you have to do a better job. And everyone's aware of the fact that they're not doing a better job. Like, the information is out there, so we know which fisheries we really have to target and work on.
Where are the worst problems? Talk about the oceans all over the world where you're really seeing the killing of marine mammals. I mean, in some places, fishing is driving certain species close to extinction.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, obviously, we have problems just with fisheries themselves being sustainable in many parts of the world, and that's just the actual fish stocks themselves crashing and losing species that way, and that's a tragedy, too. Around the world, what we did is we looked at species or populations that are particularly threatened by bycatch from exports to the United States. And we found things like the Mediterranean sperm whale, the New Zealand sea lion, spinner dolphins in the Indian Ocean, false killer whales in the Central and Western Pacific. And then we also looked at just regions of the world that represent, you know, bycatch, just the magnitude of bycatch is problematic. And those regions of the world include Western Africa, which isn't really even utilized, so to speak, by Western African nations as much as that they sell the rights to China and European countries to fish in their exclusive economic zone. And there's a huge amount of take associated with that. And Southeast Asia and the Indian Ocean are also areas where it's been reported that, you know, on a yearly basis, certain fisheries will take tens of thousands of dolphins and they'll be killed in gill nets. So, of course, the difficult thing for me is, and I've gotten that question, is, you know, where's the worst place? And, you know, whenever you start subjectively saying, you know, can I say that we value the vaquita in the northern Gulf of California, a rare porpoise, more than the Mediterranean sperm whale? Like, those are hard. It's hard to say. I can talk about species that are particularly threatened, like I mentioned, and regions of the world where the numbers are just off the charts. And all of those are opportunities for us to bring down. We can bring down those numbers, and we can save some of those species or reduce the threat for some of those species if we enforce this law.
Tell us about some of these species. I mean, these marine mammals, we know that dolphins and whales are incredible, kind of magnificent, social, highly intelligent animals.
Right. Yeah, and they really are. And we have done so many things throughout our history that impact marine mammals and still continue to do so. I mean, obviously, there was whaling that decimated populations. And many of those populations after 20 or 30 years of whaling bans are just now, I guess 30 or 40 years, are just now starting to rebound. The North Atlantic right whale, there's only about 500 of them left in the world. And the funny thing is the way they got their name, the right whale, was because they were the right whale to kill.
Oh, boy.
Back in the days of Moby Dick and whatnot, you know, of the big fishing or the whaling industry. So they were the right whale to kill. And that name stuck. And so it's sad for them, but there's 500 left. They're really on the brink. They are threatened by ship strikes. And bycatch are the two big man-made threats to the species. And they're in a position where they really can't, given their numbers, they really can't lose more than one or two per year from non-natural causes. And that's why we really need to take these kind of steps. One of the other species is the vaquita that I mentioned. It's in northern Gulf of California. And there's only about 200 of them left. It's a rare porpoise species that really stays very close to shore. So artisanal fishers for shrimp really are the danger there when they throw out their nets. And there's a huge problem for bycatch, which is the number one threat for that species. And there isn't a vaquita anywhere else in the world. And if you look on a map, it kind of, you know why. If you look at where how Gulf of California is shaped, you know, if you're a species that just exists in that northern part, there's no way for you to move somewhere else to thrive and to, you know, and so that's why they also became very distinct, because they at some point became very isolated as a species. Fortunately, Mexico has great regulations in place to save the vaquita. They just aren't followed by the Mexican fishermen as well as they should be. And so hopefully a law like this, if it's enforced, will get them to buy into following the Mexican government's program.
It seems like, first of all, the problem of enforcement and proof, and then also prevention of illegal fishing, would all be central to success here.
That's absolutely part of the recipe for success, is enforcement. In the United States, we have observer programs that go out where we actually a certain percentage of fisheries and fleets actually take observers that work for NOAA or are contracted to work with the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is under NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It gets too complicated by far. But these observers go out and they actually will be on the ships and they'll take count of what's happening in the world of bycatch, both of marine mammals and sea turtles and seabirds and the fish themselves, non-target species that are caught and then not used or thrown overboard. And so that's a program of enforcement, because that gets reported back to the government agencies that regulate it. And it's a great way for us to have an understanding, and it's a great incentive for fishers to do the right thing. They don't have these kind of observer programs throughout the world. Obviously, it's expensive to put those kind of programs in place, but a lot of countries are part of regional management bodies. So even if they individually don't have the resources, they can join with other countries through these regional fishery management bodies and pool resources to do these kind of observer programs. And you also mentioned illegal activities, which actually that's the big problem for like the Mediterranean sperm whales. Europe has fairly good laws on the books to help some of these species, but there is illegal fishing that takes place, and they don't always crack down as much as they should, the governments in place like Italy and Turkey and whatnot. And so that is something to push, and something that this law hopefully will strengthen, making countries crack down on illegal and unregulated fishing.
How much of a capital expenditure is it to change your fishing practices in such a way that they don't hurt marine mammals?
Right. It can be expensive depending upon the kind of requirements that are put in place. And those unfortunate, and I think we celebrate diversity too, so it's fortunate as well. You know, one size does not fit all. The threat from lobster and crab pots, for example, to the North Atlantic right whale is a different kind of threat represented to dolphins from gill nets. And so you have different kind of gear modifications and expenses that would be associated with that. I do know that from talking to some Louisiana shrimpers, for example, that they indicated that putting turtle exclusion devices and other devices that limit bycatch from sea turtles and other species and helping marine mammals, that can cost them a couple thousand of dollars per fishing effort. And so it can get expensive, and the fines can be expensive if they don't follow the rules, and they can also have seizure of their catch as well as of their gear. And also using particular modified devices lets out fish too, right? So if you have a modification that helps dolphins, for example, or a sea lion, but that also is an opportunity for fish to get out of the net as well. And so there is indications about 10% of catch in some instances can be lost, or, you know, that you would have gotten otherwise can be lost. But it's a price that our U.S. fishers are already paying, and that's what puts them at a disadvantage when it comes to dealing with foreign fishers, because foreign fishers can undercut prices if they're not following our rules.
And so basically, those in the U.S. who are compliant, which you're making it sound like is a lot of, if not everybody, it's the majority of people who are out there fishing, when they comply with the Marine Mammal Protection Act, then they're, as you say, at a competitive disadvantage with everybody who's doing it in such a way that it hurts marine mammals.
Right, absolutely, because if the foreign fishers don't have to take those steps where they do gear modifications or also just not fishing during certain times of year, there's an expense associated with that as well, of course, of just limiting your catch overall. And U.S. fishers, it's very difficult for them to compete at times. And again, this doesn't get back to saying that the U.S. fishers are perfect, but it's important for us to remember that they're not off the hook under these laws, that we have ways of knowing what they're doing when they're missing the mark, and then knowing which areas that we need to help them or to really focus on and say, look, you need to shape up, you need to clean up your act. We don't have that opportunity with foreign fishers right now.
Right. Now, does complying with this law make it harder for small fishermen as opposed to large fleets?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because artisanal fishers are...
What does that mean, artisanal fishers?
I think it probably means different things to different people, but I think it's... And some of it, you know, I wonder if they're the ones who put out this, you know, because it kind of makes things sound very quaint. And isn't that something we should support? But it is, because it's really local fishers who are usually going out and catching, and they're not these giant... They're not these giant boats with mile-long nets. It's local fishers who are going out on their small boats and just throwing out, you know, their nets that can be managed by just a handful of people on the boat and bringing back in a haul that they're selling locally. And the one thing to remember about this, because those fishers, there's two things to remember. One is most of those kind of local fishers, they're not selling their products to the United States. Kind of by definition, artisanal suggests that it's more of a local market to start with. So the idea that the U.S. is enforcing some law that is going to be horrible for local fishers and tell, you know, people in Indonesia, for example, that they can't go out and catch fish for their families is totally not true, because those fish aren't being sold to the United States. Now, the flip side of that is that artisanal fisheries are actually a huge problem for marine mammals that this law doesn't really solve, because they're not exporting to the United States. There's a lot of the, for example, a lot of the shrimp fisheries in Mexico that are hurting the vaquita is artisanal fishers that don't necessarily export to the United States. And it's just people who are going out to find food to supply to their village and to their families. And it's a very serious problem for a lot of distinct populations around the world. So it's not that because they're not so quaint that they're not actually doing a lot of harm. We do hope that the enforcement of this law, though, that transfers kind of the idea of best practices and getting people to think about ways to save marine mammals, will end up helping and giving those fishers an opportunity to learn about what some of the ways they can adjust their practices to not be as destructive.
We're talking to Zach Smith of the Natural Resources Defense Council and co-author of the new report, Net Loss: The Killing of Marine Mammals in Foreign Fisheries. Marine mammals are an important part of ocean ecosystems. How does their reduction affect the ocean?
Right. Well, most marine mammals are considered, I forget what the phrase is, but they're like the
apex predators?
Yeah, they're the apex predators, right? They're the top of the food chain. Some of them more so than others, in the sense that, you know, the baleen whales that are just feeding off of krill and small, very small fish, they're very important part of the food chain, but they're not necessarily the predators that we think that, like, killer whales are, that are going after seals and other whales, actually, and dolphins and whatnot. But they're an incredibly important part of the ecosystem that they're in, not the least of which, when you think about a blue whale, that was one of the largest whales. It's the largest animal that's ever existed on the planet. And when you think about a whale like that dying and floating to the bottom of the ocean, and then the kind of contribution that body makes to the food chain itself from other species, and the kind of cycle and the circle of life that comes from all of these marine mammals out in the ocean, I don't think we can underestimate the important role that they play in maintaining a healthy environment and providing, you know, a food source for smaller creatures that then at some day become the food source for the larger creatures yet again.
What happens to these marine mammals when they're killed by fishermen? Do they throw them overboard?
Yes. In many cases, they are. There are fairly strict laws about the export of any kind of whale meat or dolphin meat around the world. So there isn't really a market for it. There are at times local markets for so as long as you're not exporting, you know, there can be local markets. Obviously, countries like Japan and South Korea. With South Korea, they bycatch the J-stock, which is a particular population of minke whales, the J-stock minke whales that is threatened with extinction. And South Korea, when they catch J-stock minke whales as bycatch, which is kind of this, wink, wink, because what they do is the minke whale ends up being more valuable on the market than the fish they were going out to go after. So I think that what happens in South Korea, from what I understand, is there's a lot of, okay, we're going after this fish, and oops, we happen to catch a minke whale as well.
Right.
And now that it's dead, you know, there's no reason why we should throw it back in the ocean. We should sell it, which their law allows. And so there's actually a lot of targeted bycatch, you know, kind of like on the sly bycatch of minke whales that is really hurting the population there. But so in some instances, then, to answer your question more directly, it can be sold locally on markets, but the vast majority is thrown back into the ocean, and it can be used at times as feed themselves. If you have particular kind of long lines, they can be, you know, people will chop up dolphins and whatnot and have that be chum that attracts fish for further fishing efforts. So it's really destructive. It's very wasteful. It would be one thing if populations were feeding off of the animals and those populations really needed to get the food. But these vast, giant commercial fisheries, that's not what happens. It's completely wasted and they're just thrown overboard.
When we talk about strengthening the laws on imports coming into the United States, exports of fish from other countries, and making their fishing practices conform with our laws, then you think about the World Trade Organization, which in many examples has basically invalidated the laws of nations that pass their own laws because they supposedly interfere with another nation's ability to do business. How does the World Trade Organization figure into this situation?
Yeah, and that's one of the pitfalls that could happen from the enforcement of this law, that when they come out with their regulations and actually do move forward with applying it against foreign countries, they have to be very careful to ensure that they don't in any way violate our obligations under the WTO. I'm not a particular fan of some of the rulings that the WTO has made over the years. They do make it difficult in the environmental world to put forward certain protections, but there are ways to do so. Fortunately, the way this law was written is that, and sometimes Congress writes laws that you know from the get-go are going to create conflicts with the WTO, maybe because they're not thinking about it or they're thinking, you know what, we don't care, this is important to us, we're moving forward. In this case, the way the law is written is really okay, hopefully under the WTO, because it just requires foreign countries to do what U.S. fishermen are doing. So there's no discrimination in that sense of treating foreign countries differently than what how U.S. fishermen are treated. So that's one of the first hurdles, is as long as you're not asking them to do more and you're putting a restriction on their trade that doesn't exist domestically, then you should be in the clear. And then the other thing that it will be very important is a lot of people might be concerned that we should help some foreign countries that don't have the resources, for example, to comply with this law. And there are a lot of developing countries where this could be a challenge. Unfortunately, the WTO doesn't allow us to provide special benefits to those countries in the form of training or in the form of grants or helping them if we don't give the same opportunity to everyone. And so it's kind of a perverse result of the WTO, is that you can't identify countries that really might need our help and then somehow, you know, aid them in complying with this law, you basically have to just say, look, we're treating all countries the exact same. Here's the rules. We can do maybe, and we recommend in our report that they put forward workshops where you invite everyone and provide assistance that way. And then hopefully those countries that really need the help will show up to those workshops. But as long as you do that to where you make it open to everyone and equal access, hopefully you should get around WTO challenges. I think there will be some WTO challenges, World Trade Organization challenges, from the enforcement of this law, just because it's going to be so complicated. But we'll see how that works out over the long term, and I hope that we prevail.
So what is driving enforcement of this law now? I mean, you said it hasn't been enforced for 40 years.
Yeah. And someone asked me the other day, why didn't they ever enforce it? And I've never read anything in our research of this. I've never come across anything that suggested why it wasn't enforced. I certainly don't think it was nefarious reasons. I don't think it was anyone who purposely said, let's sweep that under the rug because, you know, because I own some foreign fishing interests and I don't want them to be damaged by this. No, I think it was just, it's a huge undertaking. And that really when the MMPA was passed, when I mentioned earlier in our conversation, there was a lot of challenges of just getting applying the law to the domestic fishing industry. And now that that has kind of gotten into place and we have a program, this people started to turn to this other provision of law. And I think it was around 5 years ago, two other environmental organizations petitioned the government and said, hey, by the way, there's a law that you're not enforcing. And that... it should have officially triggered the National Marine Fisheries Service to respond. They didn't respond to that petition, but they did then announce that they were moving forward with regulations. So I think it was people's environmental organizations like ours starting to raise the awareness about the existence of this law over the last 5 years, and then the government's been now moving forward.
Now, is this issue at all related to the very serious problem of overfishing?
Well, it's related in the sense that it's very important, in my opinion, it's valuable for people to know where their food comes from and to understand how the supply of all of our food that we intake, not only that it impacts our health, but how that supply of food impacts the environment. And I think that the more information that is available to people, then they can make more informed choices. And some people may choose not to, and that's the reality. But some people will use this information to say, you know, I'm making a decision today about wild-caught fish that I'm choosing to purchase at the market, and I want to help marine mammals with my purchase, so I'm going to buy American in this instance until this law is enforced. Now, overfishing is part of the story in the sense that with these giant gill nets out there and the commercialization and the industrialization of these huge fishing fleets that can process hundreds of thousands of fish on a daily basis, I think, you can't help but sweep up other animals, you know, in the process of creating that kind of massive supply. So this is a collateral damage, really, to the overfishing and just the vast industrialization of fishing that has occurred. Maybe a law like this, although it's not designed this way, maybe a law like this can get people to say, we can't continue with these kind of practices because we just won't be able to just sweep up as much as we possibly can out of the ocean anymore without consequences.
What can eaters, people like me, like so many of our listeners who eat fish, do besides stop eating fish, which I have to say, after having read this report, I have already made a commitment to, you know, ceasing or highly reducing my intake of fish. But what can we do? I mean, you look at a package that you buy at the supermarket or whatever, how do you really know where it's come from and if it's safe caught for marine mammals, and even more so in a restaurant?
Right. Well, there's a couple things that are a couple things about that. I too, my sister, she's thrown up her hands and said, I'm done with fish. And it wasn't even about this report. It was even before that. She's just like, I understanding overfishing and understanding the issues with aquaculture as well, just was like, that's it, I'm out. And some people do make those choices. But I do think that the promise of this law is that if it's enforced, it actually takes that responsibility away from the consumer and transfers it to the government. If this law was properly enforced, you would know, actually, that any fish that you bought was operating under a regime that is reducing bycatch. If it is in the United States, it's either domestic, which we know operates under a bycatch reduction regime, and once this law is enforced, you'd know that any imported fish, if it made it into the country, is operating under a regime, because if it's not, in the future, it won't be allowed to be imported. So that's a great opportunity for people not having to query on the package to understand, like, well, was this good? Was this protecting marine mammals or wasn't it? Once this law is enforced, you'll know that there are steps being taken around the world so that any imported fish in the United States is reducing bycatch. Now, that doesn't answer any questions with sustainability. Of course, we have the Monterey Aquarium that provides Seafood Watch, that provides information on sustainability of the fisheries themselves. And then there are other species, sea turtles, seabirds, that are in bycatch as well. So it's very difficult to get information on that. I think the Monterey Aquarium is a good place to start, but their sustainability ratings don't cover the application of this law. So you kind of have to use the two of them together until the law is enforced. And then once it's enforced, at least for marine mammals, I think people in the U.S., consumers, which is what Congress intended, can sigh in relief and say, okay, we know that people are meeting U.S. standards for bycatch reduction, so I can feel good about purchasing this fish.
Zach Smith is an attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's co-author of the new report, Net Loss, The Killing of Marine Mammals in Foreign Fisheries. And we hope to hear more about this issue as things develop. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. And let me express some Happy New Year to everyone as well.